Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
The Washington Nationals defeated the Houston Astros Wednesday night to win the professional baseball championship in the United States. The game took place in Houston, Texas, on the home field of the Astros. It was the seventh and deciding game of Major League Baseball's so-called World Series, even though countries from around the world do not compete. All the teams are from the U.S., except one, the Toronto Blue Jays of Canada. The score of the final World Series game was 5-2. It was the first World Series championship for the Nationals, or Nats. The team had to depend on what had become a defining part of their recent performances, coming from behind late in the game. Team manager Dave Martinez, who had faced calls for his dismissal earlier in the season, spoke of resiliency. He said that the team needed only to win that day's game to turn things around. "Guess what? We stayed in the fight," Martinez said Wednesday, repeating what had become a team slogan. "We won the fight," he added. The Astros scored one run each in the second and fifth innings of the game. Washington had scored zero. But in the seventh inning, the direction of the game turned when Nats player Anthony Rendon stepped up to the plate. He hit a home run, and the Nationals were on the scoreboard. Two more runs followed when Nats player Howie Kendrick hit a two-run homer. The Astros never scored another run. The Nats scored another run in the eighth and two more in the ninth. "The way this game went is the way this whole season went," said Nationals first baseman Ryan Zimmerman, who was the team's first player chosen after it moved from Montreal, Canada to Washington in 2005. "What a story, what a fun year, man," Zimmerman said. I'm Katie Weaver.
Scientists say fast-spreading sea urchins have eaten away at huge underwater kelp forests in California and Oregon. The invasion by tens of millions of the sea creatures is causing the destruction of important forms of sea life. A recent count found 350 million purple sea urchins on one Oregon reef alone. That is more than a 10,000% increase since 2014. In Northern California, 90% of large kelp forests have been swallowed up by the urchins. Scientists have reported finding so-called urchin barrens, or huge stretches of the sea floor that contain nothing but sea urchins. Such growth has spread from California to waters off the state of Oregon, where kelp forests were once so thick that boats had trouble passing through. Scott Groth is a shellfish scientist with Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife. "We're in uncharted territory," he told the Associated Press. "You can't just go out and smash them. There's too many. I don't know what we can do." The explosion of purple sea urchins is one of the many problems now facing the Pacific Northwest's ocean environment. Kelp has already been struggling because of warmer than usual waters in the Pacific Ocean. In 2013, a mysterious disease began destroying tens of millions of starfish. One starfish species, called the sunflower sea star, is the only known creature that seeks to feed on the purple sea urchin. Also around 2013, the purple urchins had two very good mating years. With no animals feeding on the urchins, their numbers continued to grow. Steve Rumrill is a shellfish expert at Oregon's Wildlife Agency. He told the AP the huge growth is being driven by starvation. "You can imagine all of these small urchins growing up, each one of them looking for food, desperate for food," he said. Rumrill added that while he has seen major population changes in sea urchins before, nothing comes close to the latest explosion. Scientists say they are not yet sure if climate change is to blame, but they suspect it did play a part in the events that helped the purple urchins spread so quickly and widely. Nora Eddy is a director at the Nature Conservancy California's Oceans Program. She gave another reason for the explosion. She said the area's kelp, which has already been weakened by warming waters, is not able to regrow itself as well as in the past. "We're going to see climate change as a big driver of changes in kelp forests as we move forward, and we are already seeing that," Eddy told the AP. She is leading an effort to use drones to map and observe Northern California's remaining kelp forests. The destruction is also having economic effects. Until now, red abalone and red sea urchins, a larger and meatier species of urchin, supported strong fishing businesses in California and Oregon. A study released this week by the University of California, Davis, found that 96% of red abalone had disappeared from California's northern coast. Last year, California closed its red abalone fishery, which had brought an estimated $44 million into the coastal economy every year. In Oregon, officials suspended permits for its 300 abalone divers for 3 years. I'm Brian Lynn.
Imagine that you are interviewing for a job you really want. Most of the questions are in your native language, but the job will require you to use some English. So, the employer asks about your English skills. You might answer with the words, "I can speak English very well," or I am able to speak English very well. The two statements have the same meaning. Both can and be able to are used to express ability. In a spoken exchange, can is far more common, while be able to sounds less natural. However, when we are talking about the past, the rules change a bit. Today, I will show you how to express past abilities with could, was, or were able to, and another phrase you may have heard before, managed to. The first thing to know is that in the past tense, we express general abilities and abilities at specific times in different ways. That is important, as you will soon see. Let's start with general abilities. These are skills or talents a person once had. In the past tense, English speakers almost always use could. Listen to a few examples.
By the time he was 4, Guillermo could read and write.
In high school, she could beat anyone in a running race.
I could mimic bird sounds when I was younger.
Again, we are talking about general skills or talents, not about a specific occasion. Note that, in any of these examples, was or were able to is also possible, but used less often. You could say, for example, by the time he was 4, Guillermo was able to read and write. And it would be fine. It also might sound a little formal in spoken English. Now let's talk about specific occasions. Here is where the rules change a bit. When we are talking about a specific situation, or when noting a specific achievement, we must use was or were able to or managed to. Their meanings are very close. We do not use could. Listen to some examples.
We were able to get a really good price on the car.
We managed to get a really good price on the car.
I was able to persuade her to volunteer at the show.
I managed to persuade her to volunteer at the show.
Now let's talk more about the meanings. Was or were able to and managed to both suggest effort. They mean someone succeeded in doing something that was a challenge or took a special effort. However, the phrase managed to puts a little more emphasis on how hard the challenge was or how much effort it took. Note that managed to is fairly common in spoken English. You will hear it used almost everywhere. Now let's take a few minutes to quickly explore an exception to the rules we just discussed. Earlier, I told you that we use could for general abilities. But there are two kinds of verbs where we also use could for specific occasions. With sense verbs, such as smell and taste, and thought process verbs, such as believe, decide, and understand, we usually use could even when talking about specific occasions. Listen to two examples of what I mean.
I walked past a market today and could smell the freshly baked bread.
We couldn't decide what to get for his birthday, so we bought a gift card.
Note that the second example uses the negative form, couldn't. So now would be a good time to talk more about negative forms. The good news is that we can use couldn't, wasn't or weren't able to, or didn't manage to express the same thing, inability on a specific occasion in the past. Listen to how these are used for the same statement.
He studied for months but couldn't pass the bar exam.
He studied for months but wasn't able to pass the bar exam.
He studied for months but didn't manage to pass the bar exam.
All three sentences mean that a person was not capable of doing something on a specific occasion. Note also that sometimes, for the negative form of managed to, we say couldn't manage to instead of didn't manage to. They mean the same thing.
He studied for months but couldn't manage to pass the bar exam.
Well, that's all for now. Luckily, I did manage to do something today. Teach you how to talk about past abilities. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States faced a deep national crisis in 1850. That crisis threatened to split the nation in two. It began over the issue of slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Many Northerners wanted to ban slavery in the new territories, but Southern states believed the federal government did not have the right to decide where slavery could or could not go. President Zachary Taylor had no clear policy on the issue. He attempted to be neutral. He hoped the problem would solve itself, but he did not get his wish. In fact, the split between North and South grew wider. Many Southerners said the South should declare its independence from the rest of the country. Then, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky stepped forward with a plan to save the Union. Clay had left the Senate in 1842, but returned in 1849. He was surprised to find how bitter the North and South had grown toward each other in his 7 years out of the Senate. Clay urged his friends in the border states, those between the northern and southern states, to work to build public support for the Union. He believed their support would help prevent the South from seceding. Clay also began to think about a compromise that might settle the differences between the two sections of the country. He once said, "I go for honorable compromise whenever it can be made. Life itself is but a compromise between death and life. The struggle continues through our whole existence until the great destroyer finally wins. All legislation, all government, all society is formed upon the principle of mutual concession, politeness, and courtesy. Upon these, everything is based." Clay was sure that a compromise between North and South was possible. Near the end of January in 1850, Clay completed work on his plan. Most parts of it already had been proposed as separate bills. Clay put them together in a way that both sides could accept. Clay proposed to the Senate that California join the Union as a slave-free state. He said, "Territorial governments should be formed in other parts of the Western territories, with no immediate decision on whether slavery would be permitted." Clay proposed the western border of Texas be changed to give New Mexico most of the land disputed by them. In exchange, he said, the national government should agree to pay the public debts that Texas had when it became a state. He proposed that no more slaves be sold in the District of Columbia for use outside the federal district. But he also said that slavery should not be ended in the district unless its citizens and those of Maryland approved. Clay said a better law was needed for the return of fugitive slaves to their owners. And he proposed that Congress declare it had no power to interfere with the slave trade between states. Senator Clay believed these 8 steps would satisfy the interests of both the North and the South. Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi declared that Clay's compromises did not offer anything of value to the South. He said the Southern states would accept nothing less than extending the Missouri Compromise line west to the Pacific Ocean. Extending the line meant that land to the South would be open to slavery. Clay answered that no power on earth could force him to vote to establish slavery where it did not exist. He said Americans had blamed Britain for forcing African slavery on the colonists. He said he would not have the future citizens of California and New Mexico blaming Henry Clay for slavery there. Clay said he did not want to debate, but wished that the senators would think carefully about his proposals. He said he hoped they would decide on them only after careful study. He asked them to see the proposals as a system of compromise, not as separate bills. Clay expected extremists on both sides to denounce the compromise, but he believed the more reasonable leaders of the North and South would accept it. 1 week after Clay first proposed the compromise, he rose in the Senate to speak in its defense. The Senate hall was crowded. People had come from as far away as Boston and New York to hear Clay speak. Some senators said there had not been such a crowd in the Capitol building since the day Clay said goodbye to the Senate 8 years earlier. Clay had to rest several times as he climbed the steps of the Capitol. He told a friend that he felt very tired and weak. His friend advised Clay to rest and make his speech later. "No," Clay said, "my country is in danger. If I can be the one to save it from that danger, then my health and life are not important." Senator Clay began his speech by talking of the serious crisis that faced the nation. He said that never before had he spoken to a group as troubled and worried as the one he spoke to now. Clay listed his 8 resolutions. Then he said, "No man on earth is more ready than I am to surrender anything which I have proposed and to accept in its place anything that is better. But I ask the honorable senators whether their duty will be done by simply limiting themselves to opposing any one or all of the resolutions I have offered. If my plan of peace and unity is not right, give us your plan. Let us see how all the questions that have arisen out of this unhappy subject of slavery can be better settled more fairly and justly than the plan I have offered. Present me with such a plan, and I will praise it with pleasure and accept it without the slightest feeling of regret. Clay said the major differences separating the country could be settled by facing facts. He said the first great fact was that laws were not necessary to keep slavery out of California and New Mexico. He said the people of California already had approved an anti-slavery state constitution. And he said the nature of land in New Mexico was such that slaves could not be used. Clay said there was justice in the borders he proposed for Texas. It would still be a very large state after losing the area it and New Mexico each claimed. And he said it was right for the United States to pay the debts of Texas because that state no longer could collect taxes on trade as an independent country. Clay said there was equal justice in his resolutions ending the slave trade in the District of Columbia and strengthening laws on the return of runaway slaves. He said the South, perhaps, would be helped more than the North by his proposals, but the North, he said, was richer and had more money and power. To the North, slavery was a matter of feeling. But to the South, Clay said, it was a hard social and economic fact. He said the North could look on in safety while the actions of some of its people were producing flames of bitterness throughout the southern states. Then Clay attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave the Union. He said the Union of States was permanent, that the men who built the country did not do so only for themselves, but for all future Americans. Clay warned that if the South seceded, there would be war within 60 days. He said the slaves of the South would escape by the thousands to freedom in the North. Their owners would follow them and try to return them to slavery by force. These events, he said, would lead to war between the slaveholding and free states. He said this would not be a war of only 2 or 3 years. History had shown, he said, that such wars lasted many years and often destroyed both sides. Even if the South could secede without war, he said, it still would not get any of the things it demanded. Secession would not open the territories to slavery. It would not continue the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and it would not lead to the return of slaves who escaped to the North. So, said Clay, the South would not help itself by leaving the Union. His 2-day speech gave new hope to many that the Union could be saved. But extremists on both sides opposed his plan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.